must be, although we think that your trip should end with limitations, but you must be appropriately as well, that you don't start off your needs. And then there's also, we're catering for a process where you could also register a name or attach some intellectual property rights to it. But also, we allow for a process where you can register a company and also register that name as a defensive name, such that any other person doesn't seek to use it will have some limitations in terms of how to use it and when to use it. We can get to the point relating to office and records. A company must maintain a registered office. I think this is currently the situation also in our current legislation. A company must keep records of its registered office or another disclosed location. And the shareholders and members of the public have a right to access to company records. That is a right that everybody would have. If you want to inspect records of a particular company, you could approach the company registration office currently to inspect those documents. So we are also reinforcing that particular right that you can be able to do that. And in relation to the areas of transparency, there are a number of things that we are introducing in this legislation to try and enhance transparency. And transparency relates to also a whole lot of issues, including how financial statements are reported. And again, I've alluded to the issue of digitality, that some of these things are not given to people in a very simple way. So that impacts on the transparency of companies. So it becomes very difficult for you, even as a shareholder, to read the financial statements that are published in the newspaper, because you certainly cannot make sense of them. So that's another area that we're seeking to also try and provide guidance to the legislation to say this.
Just a moment, I see. Remember, has the end up now with something he wants to do to us.
Maybe it's not a deal for the commission. Trade union given limited access to the channel once again.
Thank you, sir. I deliberately omitted that because we're covering it in the next session. That means the change of the list. Thank you. Okay, the area of transparency in this particular slide relates to the accounting records and statements. All companies must maintain accurate accounting records. All companies must have a financial year. And it will be an offense to falsify or fail to keep proper records or to publish financial statements that are false. So that will continue to be an offense. I think through this, what we're highlighting here is some of the things that we said will still maintain them as criminal offenses, because we think that it's very serious. It's a serious omission on the part of the company, and that they should be enforced through criminal means as well. All financial statements given to another person must bear a disclosure, and that basically means that a person reading a financial statement of a company must actually be certain that what they are reading is a true reflection of what the company statement is. All companies, large and small, must prepare annual financial statements. In this case, through the consultation process and through the public hearings as well in the portfolio committee, there were lots of concerns that were raised, because initially, I think even when we did a workshop with this committee on this bill, there was a proposal to say that certain companies would be exempted from preparing financial statements. Because what we thought to do was to reduce the burden of preparing financial statements for companies which may be very small companies that necessarily do not have to account broadly to the public. But as we go through the consultation, I think concerns were raised that I think if we exempt companies from preparing financial statements, we may actually encourage a situation where financial management is not taken as important by companies. So we need to give companies and to put them in a situation where financial management becomes something that is essential for each and every business, whether it's small or big. And so we've reconsidered that, and you see that the reconsideration that we made was really on the basis that it is important to encourage sound financial management for all companies at all levels, and also to ensure sustainability of companies of all sizes, because failing to account financially and failing to manage your accounts properly could actually lead to a company going down. And because of that, if we're addressing them, we're not encouraging them to actually be sound financial managers or to have their companies at least have some basic financial management requirements. And also, the other issue that came up is that, in fact, in terms of, for instance, our tax regime, you find that companies are required to produce financial statements. So if you're exempting them, you're not actually reducing the burden, because they are still required in terms of other legislation to produce financial statements. So what you should do is to encourage them to actually have that and to take it as a norm that they must produce financial statements, but that it will also encourage compliance with other legislation. And we thought that was a good basis for us to lift that exemption. However, what we are proposing, therefore, in relation to that requirement for every company to prepare financial statements, we are saying, therefore, that in order to reduce the burden, either in terms of cost or otherwise, is to exempt some of these companies from having those statements audited, because that's something else. You know, then audit could then, you know, put a cost to a company when it's not necessary for them to have the financial statements audited. And in some instances where companies are required to have their statements reviewed, we're saying that some of the companies would then be exempted from that particular second stage process. So they could prepare financial statements, but it may not be compulsory for them to have them audited. And also, in relation to like smaller companies, we are introducing, obviously, a system where there will be differential reporting. For instance, some of the reporting standards are designed for companies that are big companies. For small companies, we would introduce less onerous reporting standards, such that we don't burden them. So that would be introduced in terms of regulation. And the Commission may also direct private companies to prepare an audit their financial statements if certain thresholds are achieved. And those thresholds will obviously be articulated in the regulations that will come after this legislation. But what we are saying there is that even if a company is not required by this legislation to have its statement audited, the Commission, which is going to implement this legislation, may find that that a certain company must have its statements audited. That will be determined in terms of the size of that company, the impact it has on the wider public, and all of that. So it may, under those circumstances, require a particular company to have the statements audited. So that's basically just a control measure that will be introduced. And also, what we are then introducing as well, initially, you know, when you have not prepared your financial statement in a particular form, what used to happen is that it could be a criminal offense because it's not appropriate. And what we're saying is that should not be criminalized, because we could guide companies, we could produce templates that companies could use, or the Reporting Standards Council could provide a form in terms of how they should be prepared. But then it should not be a criminal offense, but it should be a matter of just ensuring that companies, you know, comply with that process. And then we could monitor it through administrative measures. The last aspect that I'm going to deal with on this presentation is the issue of the appointment of the audit committee. We're highlighting this issue particularly because it's an issue that through the public comments and through the consultation process that we had received a lot of attention. Shareholders in this particular case would appoint the audit committee as a subcommittee of the board. A lot of comments that we received from particularly the, I think, the internal audit. The company would have a board, and then the board often would have then an audit committee, which then becomes a subcommittee of that particular board. So in terms of this proposed legislation, we're saying that the shareholders must be the ones that appoint the audit committee as a subcommittee of the board. And there were a lot of comments that were basically suggesting that it should not happen like that. The shareholders must just appoint the board, and the board will appoint the audit committee. But I think over the review process that we went through, we actually noted that that may actually go against what exactly the audit committee should be doing. Because there must be some form of separation between the board and the audit committee, because the audit committee audits some of the things that have to do with the board. And you can't have the board then being the one that appoints the audit committee. So, most of the comments that we made publicly were that, you know, if you allow the shareholders to appoint the audit committee, they would not apply their mind. It would be the term they use to be political appointments. And what we're saying is that there's nothing wrong with it being a political appointment, because if the shareholders are good enough to appoint the board itself, then it means the board itself is a political appointment. Therefore, the audit committee might as well be a political appointment. So what we're saying is that the principle here is the separation of those functions, and that the shareholders should have the right to appoint the audit committee as the subcommittee of that board. And then the audit committee would then report, and each report will be included in the director's report to the AGM, that's the annual general meeting of the shareholders. And the filling of vacancies as well on the board. Initially, I think there were suggestions that if on the board there is a vacancy, that the board itself can fill the vacancy. But again, that limits the shareholders' rights, because the shareholders are the ones that have got the power to appoint directors on the board. And so if now the board is now able to fill the position, there's just a discrepancy there in terms of process. And we're saying that in terms of this particular legislation, we're proposing that the shareholder must be the one that appoints the board and fills the vacancies on the board. And that way the shareholders feel that they've got sufficient, credit on their board, they can delegate that particular function to the board. But as an initial requirement, it is a function of the shareholders. And that's what the current scheme is proposing. And regarding the appointment of the auditors, the bill proposes that there should be a rotation period of the auditors of 5 years. That if you're an auditor and you've audited a firm, there should be a period of rotation for 5 years, that you cannot audit the firm for a continuous number of years. So the rotation period would be a 5 year period. But also, there's a cooling off period, that if after that period that you are allowed to be an auditor on this particular firm, that you cannot audit that firm again in the next year. So there should be a cooling off period of 2 years. So that also just re-emphasizes the issue of the function of auditing in terms of what exactly the auditor should be doing. But initially, there was a sentiment that it should not necessarily be auditors, but that actually it should be the rotation of the auditing firm. But what we're proposing is that we rotate the actual auditor, because if one auditor audits the same firm all the time, I think sometimes it gets to a point where people do not trust the independence of that audit sometimes. So it's really an issue of perception management, and also just, you know, affording credibility to the companies that we have in the country. And the last aspect on my part is related to the whistleblowing. The bill proposes a certain mechanism in terms of protection of whistleblowers. We know that we've got a legislation that deals with this, the Protection of Disclosures Act. It deals with protection of whistleblowers. For instance, if you want to blow a whistle about certain things that are happening in the company, there is protection. But what we are doing further in terms of this legislation, we're proposing further protection that will also just ensure that whistleblowers are protected in terms of this legislation. Because, again, while there may be a general law dealing with that, we're thinking that for particular management of companies and ensuring that our companies are running in a proper way, we wish for people to be able to disclose, but also have further protection from discrimination, from a lot of things. So what we're providing for there is that in terms of whistleblowing, the person that wants to blow a whistle should at least terms of if companies are going to have processes in terms of who the whistleblower could blow the whistle to, the person that blows the whistle should blow it to a limited number of people, like the company secretary, like the legal, you know, people that can do something about the information, that can act on the information. And during the public comments, there was a request that, you know, we should add that the whistleblower should also be allowed to blow a whistle to the media or blow a whistle to the tribunals. But what we're saying is that, as a matter of principle, this is seeking to protect the whistleblower. And we're saying that if there's information that could be disruptive to your company, is blown outside the company, it needs to be managed properly. And therefore, also within a company, it must be disclosed to a person that could act on it. That is for the responsibility in terms of their role and function in a company to act on that particular information and to make sure that whatever, if it's an issue of fraud, that has to be prevented. If it's, you know, somebody has to act immediately without necessarily also exposing the company to maybe private companies. It's an issue of just managing that process to ensure that it's running. Chair, through you, I'm just going to hand over to Mr. Tender to deal with the other part of the presentation.
Allows the board of directors subject to the memorandum of incorporation to increase or decrease the number of classified checks. So in short, what we are saying here, really an impression is being created here that the shareholders now have got less power and the holders got bigger power in the next that way. And we are saying that is not true. The board still, the shareholders are still the supreme body, and then the board runs the company. However, the board will be given second power, not to always run to the shareholders meeting and seek mandate and go back and the like. And if you read list number two, it clarifies the matter to say, in other countries, this is how things are done. In Somali, therefore, if there is a contract or something which the company wants to do, if otherwise it will be overtaken by events, other companies will win tenders when they are still seeking money to the board, to the shareholders. So therefore, this is a matter of trust to say the board will be given certain power to run the company easily, create competitive edge, and compete with other international or companies without finding itself being defeated by just running to the shareholders meeting and that can be done. So, let number three, companies also allow to give financial assistance to third parties to buy its own shares, provided the company satisfies the organization's needs. This one was known as the same thing in the old days, that the company is not allowed to assist people to buy its own shares. So what we are saying here is that a company should be allowed to provide it can put the creditors, the solvency to the creditors that whenever you demand that a few speculators against at any time here, even if I can be set up with the financial liability. And the issue of liquidity is just to say my assets are still higher than the liability. So at any time I'm running my financial away. So therefore, what is the rationale for not allowing the company to keep the financial assets rather? So continuation of the corporate finance, the bills they need, the acquisition is approved by the board without requirement that to delay any interaction successes, without providing significant benefits to the company or protecting shareholders. I think I probably are related to that. It also permits any company to make any distribution upon approval by the board and without shareholder approval, but subject to existing equity solvency and financial solvency, and subject to excellent standards of conduct and liability position. Let me explain the issue of solvency and the liquidity we have dealt with the and then the issue of express standards of conduct and liability provision. So in this issue you may find that we have take the board to do that by taking into account that we still hold the board responsible for duty of care, fiduciary duty. Don't do anything unlawful because you will be held liable in terms of the act. So, generally, that's what I'm saying here. We are not saying the company, the board should just run with a company without having certain duties. So, the duties of company, the team code, we also impose certain standards to be complied with. And for your information, the imposed on duties of care. Those duties of care are also incorporated into this without saying we are, we are not saying the court no longer have the right to develop, to Again, directed to the country and several level, the health level, if they go beyond the law. It was further considered appropriate to require proof of violation of the director's standard of conduct, especially since I discussed report by the state statute. And so therefore, we want to allow that support to do unlawful decisions. The board is allowed certain actions that will allow the company to be competitive. That must be done within the confines of the memorandum of incorporation. I think it's self explanatory as I to all the issues. So, corporate governance in general is dealt with. This is dealt with under that F of Chapter 2, and it covers issues such as shareholder rights to be represented by probably. So it means that when there is a shareholder meeting, one shareholder may say, I'm not asking. However, I'm mandating another shareholder to represent. Whatever happens there is the power or an output. Shareholder taking at the meeting is dealt with as a section 60. 10% of shareholders may demand that the meeting. Here what we are saying is that in the fact that the company has a shareholder of Sarkanoch as an example, and then maybe there is a sort of a corruption inside when meetings are not called by the chairperson, everything is happening then. So the deal is saying, if 10% of that Sarkanoch can solicit each other's consent and say, no, let's demand the meeting, then so therefore, we are empowering the shareholders to be active in running their own company. Shareholders meetings and conduct of such meetings are dealt with sections 61 and 63, and the shareholders are allowed to abstain in meetings. In other words, abstain means that when we have to vote, some people will vote for, others for against. And others will say, no, I'm not expressing it, I'm not voting. So let's allow that to happen. And that's what the stands are saying. And they do not be held responsible to take it. Therefore, it means if you don't vote, it means that you are supporting the deliberation of the abstain. The meeting which does not conform with the quorum. It must be adjourned. And the members at the adjourned meeting shall be deemed to form a quorum at the next meeting. Otherwise, here, what we are saying is that here we are as shareholders, we find that we cannot correct the meeting that way. And then we come back again, and then we are not correcting what should happen. So, since the company may be at the front of the government, therefore, we are saying, let's deem that those who were present now are correct. I think that's what we are saying. So that we move on. Modernized rules concerning shareholder resolutions, we electronically, I think that's what we are saying. And the DDG has already talked about the issue of the e-commerce. The board directors and supervisors are there to. In section 66, therefore the duty of the board, duties of directors, listed in the state. That's how we do it. And as I mentioned, our common law, duties of directors, has already been incorporated again in the deal, and then the court can develop itself. Election of directors, in section 68, eligibility and qualification, the DDG has already said that certain people during the course of conducting business, you may find that that is disqualified and that they are not rehabilitated by the court. And then they want to form a company for rehabilitation. And therefore, what this means personal financial interest, conflict of interest, I mean, there, and the remuneration of the directors would be listed in the financial statement. Liability of directors and principal officer, I think, indemnification and directors insurance. Here what we're saying is that where directors have breached with, and it could be seen that they have breached, and it has been proven to be correct, the company should not say, no, this is my friend, our friend, that person should not be protected. That's what they're not saying. So in simple terms, we're saying, don't allow, don't. If somebody is guilty, that is the direction. So therefore, prosecute, don't indemnify. However, there's a process of finding somebody guilty. This is the, as you may recall, we have what we call judicial management in the current way. Judicial management generally, it means it is run by the department. It means generally that the court will sit in and say, this company is simply general, and then the court orders that I'm appointing as a court manager of this company in order to serve. Generally, we have found that this is not the case. That is to prevent the company from proper liquidation. And then when liquidation takes place, there are amnesties, unemployment, the impact of that company to the economy. So there was a negative impact to the economy as a whole and the employment. So therefore, in other jurisdictions, they have what is called business risk. And the concept of a business risk is designed to provide risk mechanism to a company that has financial difficulty, but has not reached the stage of its profit. In other words, we are saying this company is not necessarily really going for insolvency. If something is done, if there is a positive intervention, this company can go and be on sound company function. That's where we are. So therefore, we are not talking about insolvency. But judicial management was another process of pushing that company to go insolvency. That's what we are saying. So this is not dealing with insolvency. The question financially is right, if you bring the deal, we'll find that it's properly defined and it does not give any credit that business rescue is associated with. In business rescue, it is protected. Therefore, business rescue practitioner, in other words, the person who is appointed to represent in that company is called business rescue practitioner, is given appropriate powers to control the process, including power to suspend transactions for us. In other words, when that person is appointed, that person will have to consult with stakeholders, including the chief, the White House, and the other stakeholders, and discuss this and say, I think that transaction, if it is suspended, we can go. So that person is out. Consultation process is provided for in the deal, and then there are stakeholders which are listed there. Notably, the chapter protects the interest of workers. For the first time, you will find that the workers, when we are in this process of liquidation, they were not in the deal. But in the labor law, you will find that the thing is 6 to 29 instances, they are not in order. So it's in cases now. What this deal wants to say is who is the stakeholder? The stakeholder, the immediate one, the creditor, the shareholder, and the worker. Because we want to resolve the case. All of us, we have to do the same. I think that's the right time.
So,
that issue is the duty of the code. Providing access to financial statements. You will find that during liquidation, the liquidator will put all information and therefore the cost to just confirm. However, here we are saying, who can initiate this issue of defense? The work has been done. So, in order for you to do that, you need to have relevant information. Without information, you can approach the court, but if the court is true, without information, then you have a problem. So, we are saying only for the purpose of initiating business events for training, you have access to financial but under certain conditions, respecting the potentiality. So that's what the intending to do. That was not the commission. And then recognizing them as creditors, that is the worker of the company with a voting interest to the extent of unpaid remuneration. So therefore unpaid remuneration qualifies them to be today, here now, out of a credit. And starting consultation with them, the development of different states, different recruitment. There must be a business plan by the business practitioner. So they must make also meeting calls. But just in passing through what is for this today, the business rescue practitioner should contact a proposal. It's after consulting the proposal that the business strategic plan should be approved. It is not in consultation. Maybe we know the difference between in consultation and after consultation. After consultation means that I can consult with you, we can share whatever we need to share, but the decision is still mine to go ahead. I'm still acting on democratic principles. But in consultation, the word in means that I cannot go forward. It's a requirement. Therefore, because we said business rescue process, this is only 6 months. So much that if we take time, then that company will be liquidated. Therefore, give power to the business rescue practitioner to actually speak without undermining a democratic process. According to the workers of the group that has to buy out any dissenting creditor who has voted against approving a recruitment. In other words, if somebody say no, I'm not supporting, I want my 1 kilo. Okay? There can be some agreement, like to say, yes, 1 million is not so relevant, more than saving the company. Let's say this as an example. And we are trying to support out. Same for the workers are aligned with the insolvency act. For consistency with regard to equal treatment of those claims. This is also in line with the preferred ranking of employee claims in terms of the Insolvency Act and the International Labour Organization, which was just a convention. The deal as it stands caters for development of business plan after as well as explained the after and the in with all affected stakeholders. Just of course, business rescue practitioners report will be available to trade unions and employees in terms of the deal. In other words, the business rescue practitioners will then start to work and produce a report and report to all affected stakeholders. And then, so that will be the democratic process that will take place. There was a process, there was a problem with the designation on the issue of whether pension scheme through Providence. So we had to widen the definition of the pension scheme for pension Providence. For this scheme to really to work effectively, Okay, so captain dealing with a legal framework. But we need to go into this. There is a committee, a company, the intellectual property committee. So that committee should, amongst others, efficiently and effectively register local and external companies, accurately maintain proper records and information on companies, promote education and awareness of the legislation. That issue of accessibility to the general public. So there is also specialist committee that can be created to advise the minister, and then another one is to analyze the resources of the commission so that that commission should be properly resourced and implemented. And then companies tribunal to, amongst others, resolve disputes in a transparent manner. Also, the takeover regulation panel, which now, as for now, we take the regulation panel, but now the takeover regulation panel to regulate affected transactions and offer systems of certified of the deal. When I started to do a presentation, I talked about the body called Financial Reporting Standards Council that sets the standard financial standards and advise the minister, and the minister issues them. So this is the body we have. It works with several financial reporting standards and also develop standards for small businesses. So here, I think this is my last slide. Here, generally, we are saying the company X, there is a company X for now, and the group for X. So we have two companies, we have two legislations that regulate companies. And then we are saying, and this year, and it's introducing something in a sense that, one, we are going to have the Companies Act, which is one, which in it, it will have the close corporation incorporated within this. So what does it mean? If this act comes into operation, say, tomorrow, as an example, tomorrow the act is coming into operation, it means two things. One, all those corporations which were in existence will continue to exist indefinitely. But if somebody wants to register a closed corporation, they are just tomorrow. That person is no longer allowed to register an income. I hope I see. Yeah. So, we have two legislations for now, those corporations and the company. So they are running currently for current. Say no. Today, it is coming into effect today. Those two acts now are fused into one. They are sort of naturally there. However, those people who were being governed by the closed corporation will continue to today and tomorrow until they make a choice, which I will tell you what choice. Somebody wants to register a close corporation today or tomorrow when the act is in operation. That person will not be allowed to do that in terms of his deal. He will be allowed to do it in terms of his deal, but not through the close corporation which is at hand. So, another issue is the same. Close corporation which are in existence can make a decision to convert, like now it is nothing, to convert into a company. But the convert is not true. Otherwise, the company, as for now, should not convert to be a good company from today on. I hope I make good sense. Yes. So that's the future which I want. wanted to clarify. So with those few words, I think I'm concluding my talk, but there is an official conclusion to the whole presentation. Mine is just a minute. Okay. Thank you.
Just to conclude on all of this, I think throughout the presentation, I think we should, for the benefit of the committee, just summarize the key things that we think that this bill is coming with. We've spoken about simplicity in terms of the registration process. We talk about flexibility in terms of the structure of the company, if the way it's going to be incorporated and what form it's going to take. We've spoken about it. What is important about this? And important, again, in relation to what McDonald has just alluded to, in relation to the relationship between the Close Corporations Act and now this proposed bill, is that if this bill is introduced, the system is going to be simplified such that there is no need for a person to choose to do a Close Corporation. The avenue for Close Corporation was introduced because of the difficulties that existed with our current regime of incorporating companies. So we have simplified the process such that, in fact, if to register close corporation is easy today, it's going to be even easier to register a company. That's what we're saying. So that means even if the avenue for registering close corporation is going to be closed if this act comes into the picture, it's not going to impact negatively on those people that chose those corporations and others, because now it's going to be even easier to register a company. So I think that is the important point that we want to make in relation to why we're talking about simplicity, why we're talking about flexibility. You remember that the reason that we had those corporations was because the way and the way the form and the way the company is defined is such that you cannot even maneuver, because there's no flexibility. Therefore, for you to do anything else, that's sort of it's closer to a company, but that is simple. You have to choose another type of a company. So in that case, then, we're saying that there's not going to be any need for this distinction, that we're going to have a system that is going to be simple and flexible to accommodate both what the economy and the market requires at this point, and also what people in the close corporation regime need. So we're going to bring that through the calculator. And then the second aspect, I think what we want to also bring to the attention of the committee is that this bill is going to also champion the corporate governance aspect of company regulation. As it is currently, corporate governance is done on a voluntary basis. Although a lot of companies have got systems and they also adhere to the team code, we believe that there are certain aspects that are very essential to running a business and conducting a business. And those ones that we think that are basic and are a necessity, they should be incorporated here such that they can be enforced. And what we're saying is that this is going to encourage a culture of proper corporate governance, and it's also going to put an element of accountability and responsibility to the directors, and also that when directors are appointed to on company boards, they will take that job seriously, and that they will only take up what they are able to do and what they are able to perform. I'm just giving an example. If you're sitting on like 10 boards, for instance, all of them, they meet 4 times a year. If you calculate the number of times that they meet and some of the special meetings, then you actually ask yourself, at what point do these people apply their minds to the activities of those boards? So this is going to encourage a culture where boards are functioning differently. People take the board appointments seriously, and that then it will also improve the efficiency of companies, such that companies now have people that have the interests of those companies at heart. The other element of that is also that the proposed companies bill is also introducing the element of being able to disbar a director, which if that director has been found to have violated this particular legislation, or where a director has been found to have violated another legislation which has to do with that person's duties and functions. So what we're saying is that if a director has committed an offense, in another legislation, that director could be disbarred from serving as a director in any other board in terms of this legislation. And we're saying that that is also an element of introducing a way of putting some sound directorship and the functioning of directors in companies, and that can only improve the way our companies operate. And the other element that is being introduced as well, that is alluded by McDonald's, is the issue of business rescue. I think what we're moving towards is where the focus is going to be more on saving the company from going under, as opposed to looking forward to a company going under as if we are looking for them, because the effects of companies going under are more severe economically and also severe in respect of the impact on labor or workers as such. So what we say is that we need to have a focus that will look at making sure that the companies are safe from going under and that we put in measures that will assist them. I think what we've seen as well that has been obviously in the news is what has been going on in the U.S. with some companies going down and then being rescued before they can go down. I think that can only be good for the economy, because it's never a good thing when companies go down. And so that's why we think that this bill is also putting that element of focusing on ensuring that our companies are operating efficiently, and that where there is financial difficulty, there could be interventions that could resuscitate them and avoid liquidations, which may have more disastrous consequences for the economy. And the last aspect I think that I need to just allude to is the aspect of indemnification of directors. What we are introducing again here, which is an issue that is linked again to issues of governance as well, is that companies are not allowed, in terms of this act, to pay a fine for the sense of a director. If a director of a company is found guilty of a particular offense, a company cannot pay a director's fine. And these are some of the elements that we're putting in here, such that you find that sometimes companies, directors become serial offenders. They mess up this company, they come back in another company, they mess up that one, so they become serial offenders without somebody putting a stop. And sometimes companies put up insurances that will cover those kinds of things. The thing is that some of the insurances are clearly saying that you cannot cover somebody for a criminal offense. If they are found guilty of something, the insurance will say we don't pay out. But companies find a way of structuring their own indemnities to include things like this, such that you find that directors are protected from being liable to some of those things. So if a director is found guilty and there's a fine imposed on that director must then take that money out of their pocket, such that they feel the pinch of it. So the companies must not cushion them, because this is not in the best interest of the economy, it's not in the best interest of any company. So we try to also introduce an element that will manage that. Members, we have come to the end of our presentation, and the last thing that we just need to mention is that obviously if this bill is approved by both houses, obviously as soon as it's signed into law, we'll kickstart the process of raising awareness upfront, such that we then prepare the market, prepare companies for that they're able to comply with it, because at the end of the day, we are better served if the companies are able to comply with this than to not know about it and therefore, putting more resources on enforcement and thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Madam Deputy Director General and Mr. Nechitenge for the presentation you gave us. Honorable members, we have been listening. I believe we were taking downloads. I show honorable Kobeni, like most of the time, it's among those there are so many questions or some comments to me. Now it is the members' turn. I recognize honorable Kobeni. Honorable Deme, honorable Douglas, honorable Temba. Yeah, for the meantime, the first bite in that order. Honorable Kolweni, Honorable Tembe, Honorable Douglas, and Honorable Temba. Can in the meantime, Honorable Temba take over for a while now, and check something.
Thank you, Chair. I must indeed
thank
the appreciate
demonstrate the level of clarity of the presentation. I enjoyed it. And I also have commended the skill of people, which really take us through the track, tracking through the pages. And when this was started, all that it makes one feel comfortable just at this point. Having said so, Chairman, Honorable Chairman, sharing. Having said so, I must just as well say that the summary by the DDG, in a way, exhausted some of the questions I had, particularly in that level of shared directorship, divided focus. Because I wanted to check what measures are put there for politics. Because a lot of companies face liquidation because of the financialness of the directors. If values pay to us, this deal now takes into account that a director will sing in his or her music without being purchased by the company. To me, it makes sense. But coming to that business rescue practitioner establishment, I think something is silent to me, because the stakeholders like workers and other people, they come to the table. If they are only involved in that level, whereas on strategic planning, I hear nothing about it. That is important, because that's where things happen. When companies start adopting like finding progress and all that, but it's within this planning of the company. So is there anywhere where this stakeholders like what's called the workers are involved in that sort of problem? You take care of the subway. What is the relationship between this financial reporting and with the ombudsman? Today we know the ombudsman. What is the relationship?
Thank you, Honorable Kozani, Honorable Mpembe. Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I want to start by commending you for the following point, the easiness to register, because we have not so highly educated people out there but know how to do business, but there are just some little things they don't understand, so I think I have to commend that. Also, I want to commend the electronic communication issue, the plain language issue, and the name simplification. I need to commend the Department on those. But I have two questions which I'm not really clear on, two issues. The one is reckless trading. If we can just have more clarification on exactly what this is or what it contains when you trade recklessly. And the other one is I'm not yet clear on the whistleblower. The protection, I understand that they can go to the secretary or somebody. But who says that person is prepared to protect that whistleblower? Maybe that person is part of those people whom the whistle is going against. So I need clarification on more detailed clarification on the protection on whistleblowers. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Gentleman. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to commend the DDG as well as the team. A lot of my questions are answered in the presentation itself. And I think it was a very, very good and clear presentation that's very well done. I hear a lot of different people come through with different goals and stuff, and it was a very good one. Honourable Ntembe actually took part of my question, which was a bit of an interesting thing, but my concern is also around the whistleblowing under Section 159. Under 159.7a and 7b, specifically around state-owned companies, there's a couple of situations in the past where, both in the state-owned as well as in the private-owned company, the people that are listed there on your presentation are actually involved in the process, and that there's a cover-up by the company on a specific issue at board level as well as management level. Is there another process? Is there another another body or a different place where a whistleblower can go if they do not know who's actually involved and how deep the corruption goes within the company, whether it be in the company or outside of the company? Because that is a main concern for a lot of whistleblowers, that sometimes they don't know how high the issue goes, and sometimes it can go very, very high, and it can actually be a with the knowledge of the entire board that certain things are contradicting. So, if you can just give me some direction in terms of whistleblowers who have deep concerns, where can they go outside of the organization? I know there's the public protectors and a lot of other issues, but I need to know how you can define that with the legislation itself. And then, one other issue. Yeah, business rescue, under Chapter 6. In terms of the business rescue plan, the powers that are given to the practitioner, will their powers incorporate also how the board or other members of the management who actually might have actively participated in the ruining of the company, in the financial process, if they have mismanaged the company into the ground, how they then can be dealt with by the practitioner, whether there can be disciplinary action taken against them in this process, as part of this process. Because those people become stakeholders and partners in the process, but if they mismanage the company, essentially run the company into the ground, how are they going to be dealt with in this process as well?
Okay, yes, I thought I had a lot of information.
I just want some clarification on the business rescue. They say here on page 31, providing access, it protects the interest of workers by providing access to financial statements. But then on page 12, at the bottom, it says on the leading office and records, trade unions even limit access to financial statements for purposes of commissioning the agency business rescue process. Those sometimes the workers are part of unions. I mean, like unions are made up of workers' arms. Even those two things in clear in conflict, because if you give the workers the access to the financial information, surely it's very easy to just give it to the workers, to the union thing. And then it will require our first to not to give them limited access.
May I also check if this law is entitling the system to have a provision? Secondly, having been informed that the internal audit appointment done, but one thing I was very clear about, you said the report will be processed somehow through the process of the during the AGM. But what I want to check is internal auditors to the account. shelters or what of the letter? The electronic registration. I want to check if there is a need for what happens. Not against what it is. Form of
My question is on the page number 6 in your presentation here. I saw there's a lot of this close cooperation, and this seems to remind me they used to, a lot of these publicly holding companies, they used to do bridges under the close cooperation. Now, due to the new bill, those of company must they convert to the company or they can stay at the CC. Are we regarding it as active company or non-active company?
Thank you, Chairperson. Next time I'll make sure that I raise my hand to
second the question.
Yeah. but I've got a few. I think it's going to be It may be, if you can explain to us, you said a meeting that's not formal quorum must be addressed as the members, and the address meetings are meeting formal quorum. What will happen if, for how many meetings, if the quorum doesn't what's going to happen, what will happen if the forum doesn't meet, what will happen if the forum doesn't meet, and can you really explain to us who qualifies and how does it qualify as a director? And the other question that was asked, you know, what do you mean about this? Thank you.
Well, Mr. Vrachi, are you being invited?
No.
Okay. Oh, thank you, I was always. Just two, actually three new things from me. And if it happens, one or all of them have been asked my apology. Now, I want to go back to the issue raised by Honorable Tema concerning the meeting. The understanding I have is that if the first meeting does not correct, if it's adjourned, and the second one called, even if that too does not correct, I want to believe the members who will be there will be deemed to inform the quorum. Is that correct? Now, let's say the first one, all the people to attend are supposed to be 10. The first one had 8, and the second one this time has 2. Does it then mean, since it is the second meeting after the previous attendment, it does correct? Or it only corrects in the event of the number of those who turned up in the previously adjourned meeting telling us also this time which way does it go. Secondly, on page 14, it is indicated that shareholders must appoint the board. Am I right? All right, let's, I got it wrongly. Let me just check. Who appoints the board? Is it the shareholder? Okay. And then it is also indicated that it is the very same shareholders who should appoint the audit committee. Internal one, so to say. Right. Now, here we have the internal committee, and there we have the board, both of them appointed by the stakeholders. Now, there is a query between them. Perhaps the stakeholders, the board, is dissatisfied with some of the things done by some members of the audit committee. I tell it, they will have to appeal to the stakeholders, shareholders or stakeholders. Am I right? And in the same vein, the very audit committee members, in the event of them having some complaint or some critique about some board members, they too will have to appeal to the shareholders. Am I right? And yet it is indicated here that the audit committee will be the subcommittee of the board. Am I right? Does that say? Now, does it then suggest the board as well as the audit committee have the same status? Because both of them, in the event of the quarrel with one each other, they resort to the shareholder for resolution. Do I make sense? Thank you. The last one. You know, this is just for my peace of mind. You know, this way they have been giving me a lot of problems for so long, and I didn't have a chance to ask. Now, today, I'm having it. And I was asked. This word, this word, competitiveness. Tell me exactly. We produce wool here in this country, don't we? And the same goes for Australia, New Zealand, and other countries. Now, for us as South Africans to say, our woolen jerseys, right, are more competitive than those of New Zealand and Australia in the British market, so to say. Just to give it, what then does it mean? What it is that our jerseys made of wool have, which those from Australia and New Zealand do not have, to make us say our jerseys are competitive? Easy. What is going on there? Even when you talk about this or that having to be done, it will run us down, won't be able to produce competitive.
Competitiveness, maybe.
I think there will be some punishment because it's not just a requirement. So, the issue is related about that. Here we're saying, taking the issue of Australia and as you may know, that Australia and South Africa, we usually have the wood and the land. So it seems that it's that wood and land. It's a label. The label which gives guarantee that this country produces similar or identical goods. In so much that therefore, any deal which has got this label has got a guarantee that it is from Papua New Guinea. And you know this is a big picture. Taken by the Australian system, with the letters now, not only the letters, we were given money to call out seven members of the people. So I was just indicating that maybe we were at equal par in the British market. Temple of approval, those men come from the same trade country. Now, what competitive edge that we have now that we no longer have a certain example? One may come with issues like the incentive which we have in South Africa here. That can help us penetrate the British market. Just an example. I will give us some contribution benefits in order maybe to reclaim the infrastructure which we put in place. The infrastructure which we put in place from our government, and therefore we need to claim aid from government and government so that we should have a competitive edge. In other words, if we are given incentives in order to put infrastructure in place in order to export to the British market and then take a claim as much, one may say, and in Australia that's how it is, let us know, and the lenders that we have. Therefore, one may say, South Africa is in the sort of by Australia, because companies spend and then they can pay whatever they spend. That's an example. I'm trying to be very basic. And then another issue, maybe, you may find that we have bilateral agreements, the EU agreement and South Africa. That's an example. We have that agreement in place. The British may say, we're giving quotas for from so much, and then they don't really try it. So, my understanding of the way is I think we have a little edge that we need to try it. I'm not trying to run around competitive without saying companies like maybe you can call it.
Since we are now in the greatest investment in the world, there are some things which we need to help us. I don't know how we
On the forum, the colleagues will also talk, but my understanding, maybe the example which is but my understanding is that we need to have 10 people to form a forum. And then, as we have seen, the equipment will be more or less perfect. And then, two other new people come. New people come to. And eight come. As an example. My understanding is that there will be that those eight. So my understanding is that, therefore, if we form a quorum, we should be able to do what we supposed to have done if the quorum was separate. I think now that we are forming a quorum, it's better for us to prepare. Let's assume that no new two people come, and it's only these people or these five people who come. And then today we come, we are deemed to form a quorum. And therefore, what's the next thing? Quorum is a case. We take decisions relevant to this law. That's the next thing. That's everything to time. In other words, 10 people come today, they don't form a quorum. Tomorrow they come, 10 again, and it's not a quorum. But the next thing we see that a quorum is a case. And therefore, then we go on. I don't know my colleague to talk to that.
And well, then
let me simplify it. Why do we need people to go in order for us to be able to take decisions and go on?
Also that the decisions we are going to take, even those who are not in, because they are fewer than we have to comply.
Yes, they will be bound. That is the purpose of one. And it protects people who are not in the meeting, because that's democracy. However, there is a great reason sometimes. Whatever reason, people are not attending meetings, and noticing that issues of time and the like, people are not attending. And we're running a company. We need to keep it. So therefore, the following day, those people should be deemed to be formed a forum and take relevant decisions to the minister or whatever, but these are decisions implementing the system.
Just to answer some of the questions posed by the honourable members, I'll answer on whether a property holding company is regarded as being active or inactive or non-active. The answer to that is that what is in the current company's act and also the close corporation act and what is in the proposed rule is that if they lodge their annual returns on a yearly basis, there are questions that are asked on their trading status and whether they are active or not. So even if they are a property holding company, they will be regarded as an active company if they lodge their annual returns. The question on business rescue and business rescue practitioner, there is a mechanism both within the board which addresses the report of the business rescue practitioner and what he has to account for and what he has to report on. And one of the reports is that he needs to report on the management if there has been trading which has resulted in fraudulent trading or secret trading which has resulted in the loss of that particular found in section 141 of the book. And he needs to pass that particular information on whether directors were responsible for particular information the company finds itself to the authority, national prosecution authority or one of the other regulators. So there is that mechanism which you can go to into the board to address the issue of the management by director or senior management during the administration. On the issue of defining what is reckless trading is defined in various pieces, not any piece of legislation, but the courts have defined it widely in terms of what is reckless. But in the issue of company law, it would be, for example, trading under insolvent conditions. You're going out and you enter into a whole lot of contracts to produce something, knowing very well that you can't do it. And then very well that you have the capacity of the financial resources to show solvency and liquidity within the company is not sufficient enough to understand that. So you will be trading recklessly because it has impact on the creditors and impact on the suppliers and then you can be held liable for that. Well, reckless trading would be under no circumstances, under no conditions. And you also tell fraudulent activities, knowing very well that anything in contract is not for the means that will be called as trading.
I think we'll just try to clarify on certain of the issues that were raised. One of the questions regarded first was regarding whistleblowing and what outside parties could there be to which the whistleblowing could be made. The bill provides specifically for protection of whistleblowers if it is made to regulatory authorities. In other words, people like Financial Services or the Commission in this case, Stock Exchange, the panel on takeovers and mergers, Securities Regulation Panel, and then also, and then the general type of any regulatory authority, so it could be SARS. So you can blow your whistle towards any of the regulatory authorities in South Africa, and you'll have the protection. The in addition later it could be the whistleblowing could be made to the company tribunal, to the commission itself, and then of course the auditor of the company or the board of the company. Those are the internal ones, and those are normally the people who the whistleblower might not trust. So he'd rather not go to the board or to the audit committee or to the auditor because he's not sure whether they can be trusted. But he's got the open door to the commission or any other regulatory authority. But the intention for not providing protection if you go to the press is just not, otherwise there won't be, it will become a total unmanageable situation if you allow people to come with anything that they haven't even promised, haven't got proper proof for to go to the press and make false claims or anything of that nature. Let's take on the other questions. Take this training.
Yes, the other question from the owner was the state production of electronic copies as an example. Is it possible to have signature in that? That was the question. So, financial reporting that one, as I mentioned, is that if there's a set that becomes a standard set, in other words, they research, they consult with the public, they develop, they go even international, somewhere in the building, the standard, there will be a member of international organization dealing with the financial reporting standard. So they will bring them home and the minister will ratify them to say yes, they are okay. So they set the standard and all companies will have to follow that. But if there is a problem, whether there is compliance or not, and the auditors will give it as an example, when you prepare financial reporting standards, like you will be government, but you don't have access straight to say, let me go to the financial reporting council, so if you don't forget them, that is the minister by. So the ombudsman, I take it that the ombudsman, not the ombudsman, the ombudsman is the tribunal. Am I right here? So the ombudsman, in the tribunal of the ombudsman, you may find that the ombudsman is the regulator. Whereas that one, the financial concern that some people are sitting and have two difficulties at the same time, and then somebody with a helpful language. I hold that as a sorry, my colleague will also be concerned as well.
So I think we, bit by bit, we're getting through the questions. One of the questions was, who qualifies to be as director? Basically, any person with good legal standing, in other words, it must be of proper age, not unsound mind, anything of that nature. Any person can contract, can become a director of a company, unless, of course, he is disqualified. The fact has got specific situations which disqualify a director. If he's a minor, he's disqualified. If he's unrehabilitated, insolvent, he's disqualified. And if he has been found guilty of certain offenses, including elements of fraud and dishonesty. And then also if he's been discharged from certain posts, which also on the grounds of dishonesty and guilt, for that matter, and struck off the role. So you've got the, you know, everybody is entitled to become a director unless he's disqualified in that one. He must be a person, must not be a minor. So that's the one aspect of that. There was a question on who are the other persons who may receive financial statements. This provision in the Act is just aimed at, if for any other reason, financial statements must be given to a person. There must be a statement on it that it complies with the financial accounting standards. For instance, if a bank requires financial statements of a company, or a company wants a loan of a bank, and that if the company then produces the statements, and must contain the statements in that they are complying with the financial standards. So it's just a general statement. So if you give financial statements, you must have that required statement in it. Another one question was access to records. The possibility of a contradiction that workers will have access to records, and why when they will be able to give a financial statement to the trade union. It's not quite as simple. Workers do not automatically have access to company financial statements. Only public company financial statements must be disclosed. All private company financial statements are not necessarily disclosed to the public. The access to records that are referred to in the presentation and the book are normally your register of directors, register of shareholders, that are public documentation. Every member of the public has a right of access to who the shareholders are and who the directors of a company is. But financial statements not automatically. So trade unions might need access to financial statements to start the business rescue procedure. And it's only under those circumstances when there's good grounds to believe that the business can be rescued, can they then be given access to the financial statements of a company.
There was a question of which many components that I think it was dealing with the more difficulty as a document as well as the board being appointed by the shareholder. Yes, you just got many components. Let me just elucidate the one. The function of the audit committee, we're not talking about the internal audit committee. There is an internal audit committee general. This one is the audit committee which oversees. How the issues pertaining to audit to be done. It has got an oversight say they don't choose them themselves, like they can call them to come and assist them in order to know the expertise which is there and the mentalities and the needs of people and take a decision. And then they write their own report. That's an example. Let's talk about the appointment of an auditor. They may say, no, this auditor was not trusted or whatever. And you find that the board is saying, no, this is our man, not our man. So, when we go to our principal, who are the shareholders, it must be written down in the audit committee's report to say there is a difference between the audit committee's report in relation to the appointment of the auditor or the findings whatever the auditor has made, and then all of us will tell the shareholder, and the shareholder says that whatever they that is Supreme Court. So here, we find that generally, the board represents the shareholder in running the company. Actually, the company runs the board. You know, the board runs the company. Yes. So, what we are saying here is that there is a problem. The duty of care and all those issues, the board should run the board and report to the shareholder. But it is happening that sometimes we find that the board and the audit committee, the relationship may be too close in so much that they may be close. And therefore, the question is it not doable for us to allow the shareholder to appoint straight the audit committee, which in a way is also sort of the police of the board? Don't allow the board to appoint more fully, I'm using inverted commas. So those preparations to say, okay, the shareholders, you are the principal of the board, at the same time be a principal of the audit committee, so that if there are problems, we should take this very fast. Because you know the Enron scandal, the minority shareholders reported, but nothing was done. But if the audit committee was appointed by the board and by the shareholder, it was going to be probably very easy to have that corporate governance of putting the main principle. So I wanted just to clear this issue. I don't know whether we are in somebody from the community or whatever. I wanted to distinguish the two.
In the event of the board not being an internal one within the company, not the board, sorry, the audit committee, being an overseer of all that goes on within the company, it then makes a different sense to me. I took it that audit committee is necessarily the internal one. Now, if it's not internal one, how then does it become the subcommittee of the board? Because you see, the understanding I have is that we have the shareholders represent, we have the board appointed by the shareholder, at the same time we have the audit committee appointed by the shareholder. Now, in that case, how then does this board, the audit committee, appointed by the shareholder, as much as the very board itself is appointed by the shareholder, and then it becomes the subcommittee of the board. That's where I got it confused. Because you see, if it were the board that appoints the audit committee, I think that linkage would a little bit easier for me to understand. But of course, I'm rich in other structure, so I am not able to see the way in which that can have a correct, I mean, the same channel of communication can they be still different.
Let me try to say, my colleague will assist me. There is the management, the board runs the company, right? And then there are certain directors who form the management. Yeah. And then this management should have internal processes. They can have an audit group appointed from their angle. We call it an internal audit committee.
Ah, yeah.
So I wanted to say that. this one is appointed by the board, not by the manager, who have to put system in place. By the way, when we say an auditor is outside, like inside the company, they may be auditors, whatever, for whatever that is. But an auditor for company is an external person, so therefore we have the board in appointing its subcommittee of non-executive directors to be members of the audit committee. Because we want independence. But now we are saying, let's go a step further to say, no, this board should no longer appoint for this committee. It should be appointed by the shareholder. Yes,
I think the point you're raising is exactly the point that was raised by the public members when they're asking if the shareholders appoint the audit committee and they also appoint the board. In terms of weight, this should have the same weight. So why is then the audit committee a subcommittee? But I think that is the reason for operational reasons in terms of its functioning and in terms of reporting and meeting, for instance. In terms of the requirements for meetings, there's an annual general meeting where the board reports to the shareholders. So part of the board, the director's report, would include the report, which is an independent report of the audit committee, and then it will be presented there. So what could happen is that, in fact, the step that the shareholder is the one that appoints the audit committee, the shareholder could demand, if they're thinking that there may have been interference or there's no independence between the board and that audit committee in a sense, then they could demand that the audit committee be part of the meeting to present that report themselves. So I think in terms of making it a subcommittee is really for management purposes, not in terms of whether who reports to whom. But ultimately, at the end of the day, both of these committees, they would report directly to the board on their functions, which are different. So I think it's just for proper management, and we think it will still function very well, because we can't have two boards. We can't have an audit committee, which is a board, and another board. So it just distinguishes the roles clearly. Just to touch on some of the issues that have been raised by the members, the most important thing about the whistleblowing position here, it's an extension of the protection. The company's bill does not seek to prescribe particularly who the disclosure could be made to. Any person could make a disclosure to whoever they want to be, who to make it to. But what this is saying is that this bill will only afford you protection if you've made your disclosure in a managed way to these particular people. Then you will then qualify to be protected under this particular provision. So it just seeks to set the parameters for who can be protected and under what circumstances. And in that regard, we believe that if you cannot make a disclosure to the audit committee, you cannot make a disclosure to the company secretary, to the legal advisor of the company, and all of those people, because you're not sure who's involved, then you have another avenue of going to a regulator and report to a regulator. And so what we're saying is that if you have not done it within this confines, it will be difficult to extend protection. For instance, if you go out and allege that a company board is doing certain things and then it then goes into the public and that it invents the image, when you don't even have proof, you cannot expect protection in that regard. So disclosure and protection thereof must be well managed, and because what we know is that as much as there are things that are not proper, that are happening within companies, there are also sometimes people that have put other motives in making statements about certain companies or company affairs. So you want to balance the two, such that at least it's properly coordinated in a sense that encourages whistleblowing, but at the same time minimize the impact, the negative impact that could arise from something like that. So that is really to just put into context. And in relation to the issue about the access to financial statements, I think you're correct in saying that in the slide, in the other slide that where I intentionally omitted to mention that part about workers having limited access. In the slide, the words workers and trade unions were used interchangeably. Correct. In a sense that in some instances you may find that they are workers, but they're not necessarily represented, but they may require access to information. So those are used interchangeably. But what we are saying basically is that as workers, either individually or in an organized manner, or individually as workers affected, you could have access to the financial statements to be able to assess whether the company is in financial distress for you to be able to initiate the rescue process. It's just that access that is very limited only for the purpose of business rescue. And in any other circumstances, you will not be allowed to have that access, whether you are a union or you are an individual worker in that particular. But I think the sense here is that if we're expecting the union to be able to initiate a business rescue, then we should be in a position to also afford them access to the financial statements for them to determine whether there's a need for them to initiate the rescue. And then in relation to, I think there's a comment that was made by Honourable Member Koleni in relation to the involvement of workers or trade unions in the strategic planning process of the company. I think in terms of this particular bill, we're not seeking to impose how companies should structure their own processes internally. But what the bill encourages is where companies and the trade unions or the workers have negotiated, there's a provision that allows companies to allow other stakeholders like the unions to appoint a member onto the board. So they can appoint somebody that could represent the voice of the trade union on the board. So this bill allows for that, but it doesn't impose it on these companies. And also in relation to committees, the bill allows also for a situation where companies would like to have the involvement or some advice on specific social issues. They could create a social ethics committee, which would then also advance the issues that are raised by trade unions or environmentalists in other instances. So it allows for that to ensure participation where it's possible. And then in relation to the business rescue process, when the business rescue practitioner is going to look into that, to do an investigation to that particular company within that period of 6 months, because the business rescue has to happen within that period of 6 months, when he or she is going to look into that, he's going to also be required to consult with the affected stakeholders. That will include the union. So when he then drafts the plan to rescue this business, that plan is going to be finalized after he has consulted with the union. So the trade unions will be consulted, the creditors will be consulted, and the shareholders will be consulted, so that the plan that is there will be able to be a plan that is for the buy-in of all of these people, because ultimately you are going to suspend some of the contracts, so your creditors will not be getting paid, for instance, so they have to have a say in terms of how this business is going to be rescued. So that is also accommodated in this balance. So we think that as much as we don't talk about the involvement of the strategic planning, but they are where it's crucial, there is an element of participation. And I think we've exhausted most of the questions that were raised. I mean, if we've missed anything, I think members will just remind us. But we have tried our best to address all the questions. Thanks.
Thank you, members. We still have one little document to run down before we come to whether we feel the bill is okay or need some jackup here and there or whatever. So I was going to appeal that if you don't mind, let's invite the department to run us through this process so that we can get towards the conclusion of the mission. And that there are far more serious issues to prevent us from doing that right now. I think we agree. And we invite the department to take us through the cross amendment.
Thanks, Chair. That's going to be very short. We'll ask our advisor, Johan Freedom, to just take us through that.
Your mission, Chair. This bill has been with us for a long time, Chair.
Maybe we've read too much. Maybe we've seen it too much. But please just indulge us for two or three minutes, if you don't mind, Chair. We've made available that document with the heading proposed amendments for consideration by the Select Committee on Economic and Foreign Affairs. And allow me, in fairness to all the honourable members, Chair, to say in all places that not a single one of these amendments relate to matters of policy, to matters of law, or to anything that is substantive or material as far as the provision of this bill is concerned. In fact, they emanate from a few printing errors that were made on the previous printer's proof of this bill, and the rest of them emanate from the so-called consequential amendments. Allow me very briefly, Chair, just to deal maybe with each one of them separately. The first one is under clause 30 of the bill. It is on page 37. Page 37 of the bill. There we can see how minor this amendment is. It is in line 12 on page 37. It should simply read, unless exempted, if it is a private company. And so we're simply proposing the deletion of that dash at the end of line 11 and the small Roman 1 at the beginning of page 12. And with your permission, Chair, if I can deal in the same vein and breath with the amendments under clause 69 and clause 71, because they are all consequential amendments to a previous amendment that was effected by the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. If we refer to the initial bill that was introduced into Parliament, on page 64 of that bill, there is a subclause that says, at all times, at least one director of every company must reside within the Republic. The sentiment and the thinking was clearly that there is no justification for this requirement and that it should be omitted from the bill. Unfortunately, the deletion from the bill of this single provision has had a little domino effect on other provisions in the bill, and that is what we have in clause number 69 and clause number 71. We can see there, for instance, if we refer to the bill that's serving before this honourable committee, if we can very briefly refer to page 66. Or page 65, rather. That is in line 43 of the bill. It says there, starting from clause 70, subject to subsection 2, a person ceases to be a director, and then it carries on, if the person ceases to reside within the Republic at any time when there are no other directors of the company resident within the Republic. So clearly that is something that is consequential to that previous amendment, and it should be omitted from the bill. The very same thinking applies to number 1 and 2 in clause 69 and number 1, 2 and 3 under clause 71. The next one, Chair, is clause 185 of the bill. That is on page 145. It is in line 28, clause 145 of the bill, line 28. As we can see from this amendment, we're not proposing any changing in the wording of this provision, but unfortunately, there should have been an indent. That is subclause 4B. 4B, it says a person designated by the commissioner to perform a particular function of the commission, and then from there on, the rest should be indented and go to the margin. Is the certificate, notice, decision, determination or ruling of the commission with respect to that matter. The reason for this is that portion not only apply to paragraph B, but it also applies to paragraph A, and therefore it should be indented. The next one is under clause 203, Chair, which is on page 153 of the bill. Page 153, it is clause 203, sub 1. The Minister must establish a committee to be known as the Financial Reporting Standards Council. So clearly, the word committee is incorrect. It is a council, and the amendment is simply proposing that the word committee should be substituted by council. The last one, Chair, is on schedule 3 of the bill. What we seeing here under items 1, 2, 3, and 4, they all relate to a printing error on the previous printer's booth. There is nothing of substance in that, Chair. It is merely a matter of making the reading of Schedule 3 neat as far as the numbering and the heading is concerned. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think up to now we have done what's supposed to be done in terms of the bill. But then we need to come to the conclusion as to what it is then we say about the bill and all the explanations as well as the amendments brought to our attention. Now, perhaps I need some guidance here from the members. Do we run the bill page by page or clause by clause? How big is it? It's up to page 1. No, the previous 194, and then the crosses up to 202. That's what? 203, and there are some schedules there. Which way do we go? I want some guidance from members. Page by page, clause by clause, which way? I don't want to be hanged alone tomorrow. Oh, by the way, we don't have that sentence here, so. Honorable Blanc, do you want to make a suggestion? The proposal is that we run it through, we run through it page by page.
Agreed.
Is there a different view?
Agreed, Chair.
Oh, thank you. Okay, then let's go back and get to hold of our copies.
Is it possible to do it chapter by chapter now?
I think page by page will rescue us.
Okay,
good one. So let's see, we would like to start where things concerning us directly start. And in our view, first, let's start from page 1. I think we will avoid a lot of things. No, page 3. Although there's to do with the. But if we do that, then we'll leave. Start with chapter 1 when we see. Let's start on page 2, to be honest. Right. We have had the explanations, we've given amendments, we went through the bill so many times before, we have it today. Page 2. Agree?
Yeah.
Page 3? Page 4? We must do it like we are at the Grand Prix, we'll get caught up. Sorry for that. Page 5? Page 6? How can we tell the whole company? Page 7? Page 8? I haven't heard that. Honorable Dagla?
Yes.
Oh, can you say
it?
Oh, thank you.
We do have another meeting at 2.
So you suggest it's faster. Okay, page 10? But the response is not fast enough. Page 10? Agree. Page 11? Page 12? Page 13? Page 14? Page 15, page 16, page 17, page 18, page 19, page 20, page 21, page 22, page 23, page 24, page 25, page 26, page 27, page 28, page 29, page 30, page 31, page 32, page 33, page 34, page 35, page 36, page 37, with
amendment.
Because that's where we started the group.
Yes.
That's great. So, page 37 agreed with amendment. Correct? Page 38, page 39, page 40, page 41, page 42, page 43, page 44, page 45, page 46, page 47, page 48, page 49, page 50, page 50, is that correct? Page 51, page 52, page 53, page 54, page 55, page 56, page 57, page 58, page 59, page 60, page 61, page 62, page 63, page 64, page 65,
with amendment.
Page 66, with amendment, page 67,
with amendment.
Come again? With amendment.
With amendment.
Page 67, with amendment. Page 68, page 69, page 70, page 71, page 72, page 73, page 74, page 75, page 76, page 77, page 78, page 79, page 80, page 81, page 82, page 83, page 84, page 85, page 86, page 87, page 88, page 89, page 90, page 91, page 92, page 93, page 94, page 95, page 96, page 97. Page 98.
Agree.
Page 99.
Agree.
Page 100.
Agree.
Page 101.
Agree.
Page 102.
Agree.
Page 103.
Agree.
Page 104.
Agree.
Page 105.
Agree.
Page 106.
Agree.
Page 107.
Agree.
Page 108.
Agree.
Page 109.
Agree.
Page 110.
Agree.
Page 111.
Agree.
Page 112.
Agree.
Page 113.
Agree.
Oh. Page 114.
Agree.
Page 115.
Agree.
Page 116.
Agree.
Page 117.
Agree.
Page 118.
Agree.
Page 119.
Agree.
Page 120.
Agree to.
Page 121, page 122, I will show.
Yeah.
Page 173.
Agree.
Page 174.
Agree.
Page 125.
Agree.
Page 126.
Agree.
Page 127.
Agree.
Page 128. Agree. Page 129.
Agree.
Page 130.
Agree to.
Page 121. I'm sorry, page 131.
31.
Page 145.
With amendment.
That's it.
Committee on Economic and Foreign Affairs, having considered
said the subject of the company's bill, Bill 61B of 2008, referred to it and classified by the Joint Saving Mechanism as a Section 75 bill, reports the bill with proposed amendments. Honorable Korean? Thank you very much. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. There is something for us to buy at old assembly dining hall. So please, before we leave, let's just pass the grip. Something to go. Thank you so much.
Unfortunately, I don't go to that one, but...
when are you going to go down to that school thing?
No,